The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 282.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is one of my favorite individuals to talk macro, the Great Reset, and just all the craziness that we're dealing with right now in the world. He's one of my partners in Rebel Capitalist Pro. He's a very, very good friend of mine. His name is Chris McIntosh. Chris, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my friend.
It's always great to chat with you, George, and glad to be back.
Yeah, we chat
discuss
a lot
about all the insanity.
Yeah, you know, we chat a lot about this stuff, just you and I. And I don't know, we were chatting about a week ago or a couple of days ago about this stuff. And I said, you know, we really need to do an interview on this because, the community, the Rebel Capitalist community really needs to hear what we're talking about. Because I think some of our best discussions that we have are just the private discussions when we're not recording on Zoom. So let's just try to have a normal conversation between you and I and allow the audience just to kind of be a fly on the wall. So the first thing I want to talk about is what you're doing personally and what you're going through with all of these lockdowns that are now in New Zealand. I don't know if there's as draconian as what we've seen in New South Wales and Australia, and then kind of what you're doing to maximize your freedom and the freedom for your family moving forward.
Yeah, it's a complex topic, but let's start with this. So my background, as you know, I grew up in South Africa. And from a pretty young age, I started looking at history of my region, South Africa, and then the countries north of me. And one of the things that I realized when I was back, I was about 16 years old, and I went and I did what most people would not do, and I certainly wouldn't allow my own children probably to do it now, but I went backpacking solo up into Africa during school holidays as a 16-year-old boy. I'd saved up some money. I used to push trolleys at the supermarket to earn money, and I'd saved up enough money that I could go for about 6 weeks was what I determined. And do a bit of backpacking. I thought backpacking was just the best thing. I wanted to be a professional backpacker. And so, at the age of 16, I went up into Zimbabwe and up into Malawi and what was then Zambia, or is it Zambia still? And I had some experiences that really just awakened me to the bubble that I lived in. And I looked at these countries and then I started investigating them. And I quite quickly realized that literally 20 to 30 years prior, they were nearly identical to South Africa. Nearly identical.
And this was probably in the 80s, huh, Chris? Was this in the 80s?
This was in the 90s.
In the 90s.
Early 90s.
Yeah, you and I are almost
very early 90s. Yeah. Basically 1990. Would have been 1990 that I went. So, so what I realized, George, was that what I was seeing visibly was where things had gotten to in these countries. And there were degrees of separation. Zimbabwe wasn't quite the same as Zambia, which wasn't quite the same as Mozambique, which wasn't quite the same as Malawi. But the contrast between those countries and South Africa was stark. It was quite a stark contrast. What I got to understand was that South Africa was really just 30 years behind these other countries in terms of the economic structure, in terms of the political structure, and so forth. And so, you know, quite literally at sort of the age of 16, 17, I knew that I wasn't going to stay in South Africa. I knew that the probabilities of what had transpired north of me were really, really high with respect to South Africa. And here we are today, and certainly that's borne itself out. South Africa today is unrecognizable from the 90s, certainly. I mean, that you could say that's sort of true of most countries or many countries, but only really in terms of maybe a few more shops, you know, where you are in the States. You know, if you go back 20 years, yeah, there'll be differences, but it wasn't stark differences. It wasn't dramatic, like, oh, I do not recognize this place sort of dramatic.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm actually in Phoenix now, and I was in Phoenix in the mid 90s, and you're right.
Yeah. And so you know, I understand that the policies that have been enacted in those countries were creeping through into South Africa. They were creeping through into the narrative. And then as soon as sort of 1996 hit, which was in the change of government took over, there was a lot of fear. There was this fear that there would be like a reprisal, and it didn't. It was all very calm. And it was one of the most extraordinary sort of events in history, that you had this transition of power from what was an extraordinary dictatorial power structure of a white government that had ruled over another class, that transitioned that power without bloodshed. That's extraordinary. That doesn't normally happen. And so we had that. And yet I could see, like in the universities, I could see the narrative that was building, and it was this Marxist sort of narrative. And you could see the thought process was very, very similar to that which you'd seen north of the border in varying degrees and shapes. But you could see it coming, and that was never good, you know. And so when I look at the world today, to answer your question, we have a similar setup, except it's much, much more global. And it's largely centered in socialist liberal democracies, or what used to be democracies, I would suggest. We still term them that. And so this is largely the West. We can bucket it all into the West. And we're seeing varying degrees of that. So, you know, you said, is it as bad as New South Wales? Where I am in New Zealand now, we're in a level 4 lockdown. So that's kind of the highest level. And so it's not as dramatic there. We don't have, for example, drones flying overhead, checking to make sure that you're indoors. We don't have the required mask wearing outside, things like that. You can actually go out and you can exercise, and you don't have to wear a mask, which of course is ridiculous if you were trying to exercise anyway, but nevertheless. So we don't have the same degree, but just like we had in South Africa, where I could see the ingredients for what was to come.
Right.
That's all there. And really, that's all that you need to know. And so, as you'd know, we've spent a huge, I mean, literally since I tripped over to Europe last year, which was about this time, it was September, to go and start getting a feel on the ground for what was transpiring there. I've been, you know, up countless hours with many colleagues and very good friends, trying to ascertain what's going on. And so largely there is this extraordinary push towards a Marxist economic structure of some description. And I think it'll transpire in different shapes and forms in various countries, because there's always nuances, there's always cultural differences, there's certain economic differences and so on and so forth. But what you need to know, all that you probably really need to know, is that it's bad. It's not good. It's not going to be productive. It's not going to be enhancing humanity. And so my job has largely been trying to determine where that cancer has less of an ability to take hold.
Right.
We won't say that it won't. We don't know where the future lies, but we do know a few things. And so we know that this economic structure that we've enjoyed since Bretton Woods was one where we built up institutions that we could trust, and we built up a continuous safety net. Like when you go through something like World War II, safety just vanishes. It disappears, right? Obviously, it becomes very, very raw, very brutal. And so when you come out of that, you want to fix that. It's a natural human tendency. You start with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and you say, well, I don't want to have those uncertainties anymore. I don't want to have uncertainty of food, housing, healthcare, education, and. And so hence what was built was all of these structures that would provide that level of security. And that's not a bad thing. It's just how history happens. But as it grows, what happens is the following generations take it for granted. And because they take it for granted, they don't see it as something that should be worked towards or fought for. They see it as a privilege. Sorry, not as a privilege. They see it as a right.
As a right.
Rather than a privilege. And then they demand it as a right without any understanding that it takes a lot of productivity. It takes a lot of resources to actually make it happen. Mm-hmm. You don't just get free healthcare. There is no free healthcare. Right. At least I don't know of any doctor who's going to work for free. So free just ends up pushing these liabilities onto the government. And so what we've seen is an outsourcing of responsibilities from the populace to the government. We've outsourced the responsibility of educating our children to the government. We've outsourced the responsibility of taking care of our own health to the government. And this isn't a US-centric thing or New Zealand. It's across the West. And what we're seeing now is a blow-off top in that experience, where the generations that we bred see these as inalienable rights rather than something that actually has to be fought for and provided for via productivity, right? So the economic structure that underpins that, the fundamentals that underpin all of these so-called rights, those themselves are now under attack.
Yeah, but Chris, let me insert one thing there. When you're talking about the current generations that we have just demanding more and more of these things as rights, the only way to get that is through bigger and bigger government. Because to your point, the doctor's not going to work for free. So you have to take that from someone that's producing and give it to someone that hasn't produced enough to cover their own, let's say, medical costs. And, you know, whether that's right or wrong, that's not what we're talking about. The bottom line is that creates bigger and bigger government. Or from an economic standpoint, government spending as a percentage of GDP goes up and up and up. And the problem with that is the bigger government gets, the more power they have, the more it incentivizes people who are quite literally sociopaths to apply for those positions as politicians or for our institutions that we are supposed to trust. Because by definition, they want to control other people. Therefore, the more the control the government has, the more it attracts those types of people that want to micromanage other people's lives. And I just wanted to insert that in there because I think that's very important that people understand that cause and effect.
You make a very good point. I mean, what it is you're laying the groundwork or you're providing the recipe for sociopaths to come out. They exist in society always. But there's certain fertile grounds for them and then other grounds that are not fertile for them.
Right.
And so you nailed it. I mean, absolutely. But if you think about that economic structure that allows for all of these privileges, which are privileges, they're not rights, but the only thing that allows for that is productivity, entrepreneurship, actual risk, right? It's George Gammon going out there and building a business and employing people and creating something. And then the bureaucrats taking a percentage of that in order to provide for these rights or privileges. And so that shifts. There's only so much that George Gammon can actually handle in terms of the weight of government. There's only so many people that George Gammon can carry through society. And I'm using you just as a point. It's all entrepreneurs, it's all capitalist systems or businesses within society. There's only so much that they can carry before the profit motive declines, you know, or the costs just become insurmountable. The regulations become insurmountable. And so that's where capital then often leaves that system and goes and finds another system that is better in some shape or form. And so we're actually at this point where within the Western world has been varying degrees of bad, right? And so you could have left, say, France, when you go back to when Hollande was in power, and he instituted, I think it was about an 80% tax on millionaires, on people who were earning over $1 million a year, or €1 million, it might have been. And what happened, of course, was just the wealthy people just left. They went, well, why would I give up 80% of my hard-earned money if, to stay here? It doesn't make any sense. And so they stopped bringing in, building businesses, and they took their capital and their personal selves out. And a lot of them went to Hong Kong. There was a huge influx. Hong Kong, for example, suddenly got this big French enclave. And so capital goes to where it can be treated best. And then, of course, that policy was reversed subsequently. But the point is that within that Western structure, it's all been going the wrong way, just to varying degrees. And so for capitalists like you and I, what we have often been doing is just bouncing around within that cage, within the construct of that cage, right? For example, Americans now in Puerto Rico, obviously, because you don't have the same sort of tax levels. But not everybody can be in Puerto Rico. You can't be a home builder, for example,
right,
necessarily in Puerto Rico,
right,
at least not to my knowledge. Maybe there's some fandangled tax system and you can achieve it, but I doubt it. So this entire structure is just getting bigger and bigger, and it's now gotten to the point where it is literally collapsing. And so that in itself is bringing forward a lot of these measures that we're seeing, these totalitarian sort of measures. And so you asked the question of what is it that I'm doing? Apart from, I think one of the core things has been to, as best as possible, really understand what's happening at a macro level. Because every 80 odd years, this is what we go through. We go through a massive restructuring of the world. If you and I were sitting in 1939, surveying the scenery, could we have determined what the world would look like in 1945?
No way.
It would be pretty difficult, pretty difficult. That said, there were people who could see a lot of the things that were transpiring, and they could determine that they were not good. And there was probabilities that people ran. For example, there were people who left and went to South America, which incidentally landed up being probably the best place that you could go to for the duration of that decade.
Right.
So it pays to pay attention, and it pays to really think out of the box as well. One of the things that we learn from studying history, whether it be World War II or any of these even more centralized periods of upheaval, whether it would be Mao's China, Pol Pot's Cambodia, or any of these sorts of things, there's always the vast majority of people that do nothing because they can't believe that it would be as bad as it gets, and they can't believe that it would ever happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a car crash. I mean, I remember as a teenager, I had a terrible car crash. I was not the driver. And I remember we spun across a highway and we rolled, and was a horrendous crash. The car was a complete write-off. I was miraculously completely fine. I crawled out of the car and stood up and looked around. And I remember at that point in time thinking to myself, I never thought this would happen to me. Everybody's seen car crashes and things like that, but you just think, that'll never happen to me. And then it does. And it's a similar sort of experience that, unless you conceive of it as being a real possibility or probability, and at least try and attempt to take some actions to mitigate the risk of it, you can quite easily just land up being like the vast majority. And so,
Chris, let me, why I think people fall victim to that thinking or that mindset, for whatever reason, I think they believe that they'll be able to see the writing on the wall prior to it happening, because they think or they might not even consciously think this, maybe subconsciously they think that the government or the dictator or the president or fill in the gap or fill in the blank is just going to tell you what their intentions are. And then you can go ahead and make your decision, as if Stalin came out, you know, and said, hey, guys, here's my game plan to create tyranny. I'm going to do this, this, and this. And if you want tyranny, you can go ahead and stay here. But if you don't want a tyrannical government that's going to micromanage your entire life and kill hundreds of millions of people, then you better leave now. Right? Or in 1930s Germany, as if, you know, we'll keep it YouTube friendly, as if the dictator is going to come right out and say, hey, guys, here's my game plan. I'm going to go ahead and set up all these camps and, you know, nothing to see, you know, don't worry about it. We're just going to eradicate a few million people, but don't worry about it. As though they come out and say that. Or, you know, I always use the example of East Germany prior to building the Berlin Wall. It's like the politicians came out and said, hey, guys, we've got this great plan. We're going to build this wall all around the city to keep you in so you can never leave. And if you try to leave, we're going to shoot you. And everyone says, yay, that's a great idea. Of course, my point is, of course that didn't happen. They always sell these things to you as though they're for your safety, your security, as though this is going to be to your benefit. And then only in hindsight can you see the reality of their intentions. And I think that that's what people don't see, because they think that it's going to be this explicit message, and it never is. It's always reading between the lines as to what these politicians and what these central planners are trying to do.
You know, in my business, George, it's always a matter of looking at what actually is happening, the energy sector, and this fight against climate change and going net zero carbon, et cetera, et cetera. So regardless of your viewpoint on it, if we look at that and we say, okay, which countries have said that they're going to do this? Pretty much all of them. And then what we do is we say, okay, that's the narrative. Let's go and have a look and see what's taking place on the ground. And we can see a massive divergence, you know, and I've written about this extensively. So you have China, who've promised and said, hand on our heart, we're going to be carbon neutral. But, you know, we've got a bigger economy and da-da-da. So they've got some excuses there as to why their net zero is actually going to just be a little bit later than everybody else, right? And they, and you see the mainstream media parroting this wonderful Xi Jinping is, you know, he's on board, everybody's on board, kumbaya, save the world. And yet on the ground, they're Chinese banks are the largest financier of fossil fuels, not only in China, but in the entire world. China's building 130 coal-fired power stations. China's building the world's largest oil refinery. Like, so there's the reality, right? Despite what they say. And what we have is this inability to actually just dig down and say, what exactly is taking place? Forget about the narrative. What exactly is taking place? And so when you think about
watch their actions, not their words.
100%. And that's always true. And yet it's almost like you will say that and people will go, duh, you're not telling me anything new. And yet people will still continue with the narrative. You can show them data. I mean, look at, for example, this COVID stuff, right? All of the, you know, we get caught up in the noise of, do face masks work? Are they bad? Are the vaccines good? Are they bad? And I look at it and I say, let's just dial the clock back and let's just consider this. If we look at the number 2017, for example, through 2020, deaths per 100,000 in the US, there's no difference. Virtually no difference. 2020, I think there were 8 more deaths than 2019. There was 878 in 2020 and 870 in 2019. So you'll say that. And then what happens is people, well, they can look at that and go, that doesn't sound like I'm really in danger. But then they look around them, and what they see around them is completely contrasted. People wearing masks, people social distancing, lockdowns. And then they see it across the world and they go, okay, it's because we are herd animals. They look at that and they go, well, that must be right. Even though that rational brain, it just gets suppressed, right? Because you go, well, if there's no more deaths in 2020 than in the previous years, what are we doing? If the survival rate is over 99%, what are we doing? And so, you know, there's an inability to conceive of what this might be. And if you start digging into why that might be, you can quite quickly descend into a dark place, and people don't necessarily want to see what that might look like.
Yeah, but let's for a moment, Chris, let's for a moment assume that I don't think anyone disputes the case fatality rate. But let's say that the cerveza sickness is something you don't want to get because it's different than the flu from the standpoint of long-term side effects. I mean, I get it, and that could very well be true. But just because the cerveza sickness is not the flu, let's say, and it can have some very significant long-term side effects, that's not what we're talking about, right? We're talking about a cost-benefit analysis between that being the benefit being that fewer people get the cerveza sickness. The cost is what most people ignore. And so, like, as I use 2020 as an example and say, okay, let's say that through these lockdowns and paying people to stay home and all the measures that were done in the United States, that we saved X amount of lives or X amount of people didn't get the cerveza sickness that otherwise would have. Okay, that's a benefit, but what's the cost? They say, well, you know, so what? So people had to stay at home a couple months, big deal. Kids had to wear some masks, who cares? But they completely ignore inflation. And they completely ignore the fact that it's most regressive tax that we have. It affects, it massively or disproportionately affects the poor and the middle class. And that their cost of groceries, let's say, went up by 20%, that's not going back down ever. So the poor and middle class are going to have to be paying that cost, if not more, for indefinitely. It's not going back down. So this is what I always try to get across, is it's not just, okay, because they'll sit there and you got one side that will say, COVID isn't bad, COVID isn't bad, COVID isn't bad. The other side will say, oh, it's bad, it's bad, it's bad. And then you never make any progress. And I think that's missing the bigger picture, that sure, it's bad, but we don't have any ending to this movie where you know, it's all rainbow, sunshine, and unicorns, where nobody dies and we all sail off into the sunset happy. That's not an option
right now.
So we have to figure out what the least bad option is. And throughout history, that's the option where we maintain the levels of freedom that we had prior to going into the issue in the first place. All right, guys, we had a little technical issue right there with the internet. We're back here with Chris McIntosh. So I'll have the editors kind of clean up that last bit if they can. But Chris, one thing that you and I have discussed at length, in addition to, you know, these draconian measures and all the craziness that's out there with people just not doing a cost-benefit analysis with the cerveza sickness, we'll call it. But a lot of my viewers completely agree with you. And even the ones that maybe don't still say, okay, I need a plan B because I just don't want to be in the middle of all of this insanity for the next 5 years or however long this lasts. So they've been thinking about kind of a plan B, whether that's kind of bugging out here in the United States. A lot of people are thinking about moving to Texas or Florida or maybe Idaho or some place that's more remote in the state where they live. You have done way more research on this than anybody I know. So I want to kind of pick your brain and hopefully you can give some insights to my viewers on how you're thinking about this that will really help them make better decisions. And one of the key things that we discuss that I think most people miss that you've studied so extensively is food. And, even the people that, like, say, well, I'm going to get the heck out of California, I'm going to go to Texas. Or, you know, me, I was saying, well, I'll just go back to Florida if need be. that's okay. And then a lot of people say, well, I'm just going to bug out and grow my own food. But me included, I don't think we've really thought that through. So can you enlighten us there on your research?
Okay. So let's start at the top. Let's start at the 40,000 foot, and we'll drive down into each individual situation, because there's certain actions that people can take depending on their resources and their means, right? And so for some people, it's going to be getting on a plane and it's going to be going to the other side of the world. And for other people, it's much more domestic, shall we say.
Right.
So from the top level, what we do know, when you go through economic decline and periods of crisis and economic turmoil, mm-hmm. what we as human beings do is we go tribal. We go back to our roots. And even if we don't even have roots, we find roots. And for example, what you will see in periods of economic decline and distress and uncertainty, one thing that happens is religion becomes more important. People become religious, right? And you go, why is that? It's because you're finding a source of stability, wanting to find a source of stability in a world that is So what's going to happen globally, and we're already seeing this, is people are going to their, shall we say, their kin, right? So if you take cities that are incredibly multicultural, firstly, cities are not where you want to be for a host of different reasons. But if you've got a very, very multicultural type of city, that can be a problem when you go through uncertainty. Because what happens, George, is that if you lose your job and you go through some, you know, you have a bad economic time and a bad experience, often what we do is we look to blame somebody. A lot of people don't want to look internally and go, it's my fault.
Right.
And especially if some demagogue who stands up and says, George, it's not your fault. It's those people.
Right.
It's the capitalists. It's the
unvaxxed.
It's the whatever. Okay. Because it's very simple. It doesn't require any thought. And it can immediately be brought into action. Okay. So we see that happens. We can expect that. In fact, we're seeing it now, and we can expect more of it. And so that's that's splitting society along whatever grounds. It could be racial, it could be cultural, political. It can be equality.
Democrats hate political. The Republicans. Republicans hate the Democrats. Yeah.
Exactly. So we can see that on a global basis. And so what's interesting to me is to find places that have less probability of that transpiring for a couple of things. One could just be they're more homogenous. Two, they could be have essentially a community-based society that is much that's not reliance or as reliance on government. So, for example, and I know we've mentioned this before, the country of Georgia. So Georgia in the Caucasus has a very, very strong religious Eastern Orthodox background. They have heavy influence within the government, and most people go to church. And so there's the very strong community aspect there from that. Also, they've been through hell. I mean, you go through their history. They very robust, very, very tough sort of people. And so in times of economic distress, a society like that has a higher probability of staying together and not tearing each other apart, right?
And they've been through socialism.
They've been through socialism. And you can see this if you look through the history of, say, Constantinople or any major multicultural city. They boom. When times are good, multiculturalism is fantastic. It brings new ideas. You suddenly have a Pakistani restaurant on the corner, and then you've got an Indian one, and then you've got some Turkish rugs that you can put in your home. It like life gets better when everybody's making money, and you can see past the differences. You don't really mind if the chap down the road doesn't speak English so well and he's a Turkish immigrant, and you know, so on and so forth. But when times get bad, that's when those things fracture, and people go back to their tribes.
Yeah, they get very tribal. Yep.
So within the United States, what we're seeing now is very, very similar to what we saw in Yugoslavia. People now are moving to their tribes. Yeah. It's you potentially, if you were in California, saying, well, this isn't really my tribe. I might be moving up to Idaho or to Florida or, you know, so on and so forth. And so people are moving to their particular tribes. Typically what happens after that is that they decide where those borders are. And that's when you get conflict and you get a restructuring of that society. Okay. So I think that's coming. The probability of that is certainly extraordinarily high. You asked about food.
Yeah, and so also two one food's more a very thing big on one
for me because
one more thing on food, Chris, is if you could explain how the ESG movement plays into that, and then also the Great Reset agenda into food, so, the yeah. production of food as far as the amount that we enjoy globally today.
Yeah. Well, and this isn't specific to food, but it's very important because food is absolutely critical. If you think about how you could control a society, it's information, and then it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's your accommodations, and it's your food and water. And so if we look at what's basically post-World War II, we had this extraordinary globalization, and it paid to become more specific and more specialized in every little industry, right? Mm-hmm. So you, the farmer, didn't sell your goods at the farmer's market anymore. You sold them to another person in the chain who would aggregate all of the various farms around you, and they would distribute to another supermarket chain or whatever the case might be. So the components of just someone growing food and someone selling that food to you have been split into multiple different parties. And so that break in that chain, that extensive chain link, is now massively under pressure. While it's under pressure, it's also being centralized. And that's very, very, very important. So if we look at much of the Western world, America's a great example. America has all the food that you guys need. But the problem is that food is very centralized. It goes through large, large corporations who've bought up tons of land, who then have rights on lots of land, who then control distribution of that food. It's very, very centralized. Now, if, for example, tomorrow you could not get into the supermarket because you need some specific pass, a green pass, for example, to purchase your food, there's not a lot you can do. Right. Dependent upon where you are. And so what I've been very, very focused on is looking at essentially countries and regions that are already decentralized in terms of
their food supply chains, right?
And where it's locally grown, and where, you know, you would go and you'd buy it from the local farmer's market, because to control that is much, much more difficult because it's just a farmer's market. And even if you could control the farmer's market, you can make a work go around. You just go to the farmer and you buy your eggs from the farmer, right? It's not difficult. It's very difficult to control that as a central, have a central force that controls it in a decentralized food network. The other thing, and we've talked about this before, if you say, okay, fine, I'm going to be self-sufficient. I'm going to grow my own food. Well, that's fine. You grow your own food and you might even feed some of the neighbors and everything else. If you have some problem with that food supply, and we're going to have it, it's absolutely, I'll eat my hat if we don't have basically food shortages taking place. If that happens, you can sit there and say, I was right. Fantastic. I've got my hedge. I've got my vegetable garden. I've got some beef cattle. I've got my chickens, my tilapia, whatever it might be. The issue now, if you're in an environment where you're the only party that's done that, you have a problem because now you have to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I go back and I think about, because I've seen this with friends and contacts in South Africa who literally did the same thing. They said, it's fine. We can see all the problems. We've got our own farm. And we connect with the other farmers in the area, and we'll be fine, even if they shut us out, and we'll be fine. But guess what? They just got picked off. It's very, very difficult to protect a farm when you have a mob of people coming at you.
Right.
Very difficult. So then you have to, you know, no man is an island. You can't be that individual trying to ward off. I mean, I know this sounds like Armageddon type of talk, but this is, you know, we need to address these as realities. So you don't want to be, for me, it's much easier to just drop into an environment where that decentralized structure already exists as a consequence of how that particular economy works, because the risks to that society are much more mitigated. If you have breaks in that chain, it doesn't affect them as much, right? But you think about how many average, let's say, New Yorkers or Californians, if the markets ran empty tomorrow, how long do you last? I'd say it's days, maybe a week, and then you've got real chaos. And if you have that, it's an extraordinary ability to come and institute, say, martial law, emergency powers, rationing of food. So you move very quickly into a situation which you don't have a lot of control over. So when I look around the world, I've been looking for places that have that sort of decentralized food structure, where you can, if you want to, grow your own food.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Chris, it's funny you say that, because I'm just thinking through all the time that I've spent in Ecuador and all the time I've spent in Colombia and in Montenegro. And I think about how many times I've been in towns or villages where anything you could possibly want would be grown just within a 2-mile radius. Fruits, vegetables, meats, milk, you know, absolutely everything. And when I think about the United States, I don't know if I've ever been to a place in the United States where, you know, obviously I've been to places where they grow a lot of wheat, or they grow a lot of corn, a lot of cattle, dairy farms. I've been all over California where they grow tons of, you know, areas where they grow tons of berries or, you know, fruits, vegetables and whatnot, but never everything within like 2 or 3 square miles, like you see in these countries like Ecuador, like Colombia, like Montenegro.
Yeah, it's George. So, you know, that's been the benefit of globalization, right? If you're in Florida, you got tons and tons of like oranges and citrus and stuff like that. So what you'll do as a farmer, you'll say, I'm not going to have pigs and chickens and like all these.
I'm just going to do what I do best.
One thing. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to do that, right? And then all your neighbors do. So you just have these massive swathes of land that just grow oranges or whatever, okay? And that works in the old world, right? But So you've got your oranges, fine. But here's the problem. You're selling those oranges already to a large corporate entity that can easily be coerced, right? I'll give you a perfect example. Here in New Zealand, there's a company called Fonterra. Fonterra is the largest company in New Zealand. And they are essentially a cooperative that buys all of the milk from the dairy farmers and then turn it into butter and everything else, and then sell it globally and sell it through multiple different chains. And you really, if you don't sell your milk to Fonterra, there's no real opportunity. Like, you've got nobody else that you can sell it to. There are a few little operators who try and do like raw milk and they sell it to the local market and all, but by and large, they're less than a decimal point. And the ability to step, if you're going to be a dairy farmer in New Zealand, you will be co-opted into that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what they're talking about and they're bringing in here in New Zealand is something called, well, it's been in place for years and years. And it's what's called occupational safety and health. Okay.
OSHA. So
all of these farms that are producing this milk have to abide by certain standards. You know, you can't have sewage running through your milk production, whatever the case might be. It's all got to be safe and secure and et cetera, et cetera. Well, now they're bringing in that you need to, in order to be safe, you need to have your staff be vaccinated. Mm. And so your farm, if you've got farm members that aren't vaccinated, well, they're not going to pick up your milk. So you could have this farm, but you're screwed unless you do as they tell you to do and get your multiple jabs every 6 months, and might as well just put you up to a fucking drip and just anyways. So that's similar to what you've got in the US, and it's similar to most everywhere in the Western advanced world. Right. It's not something, as you mentioned, Montenegro, which is one of the countries I'm interested in, along with Serbia and much of that Eastern Bloc, they're much more decentralized. You've got a farmer who will be often growing a number of vegetables. They grow vegetables. They don't just grow carrots. You know, must have been a month ago, I took my son snowboarding down the mountain, and there's you know, down where we go, there's a lot of carrot. They grow carrots down there, and that's all they grow. So you've got these farms and just carrots. And you don't get that. So one of the places I'm particularly interested in, for example, is Costa Rica. So in Costa Rica, you know, you've got all these tons of little farms. Serbia is another good example. I've just been researching last week. And so you've got, like, I think it's 80% of the actual, the structure of that food economy is family-run farms.
Mm.
80%. So you contrast that to, say, Canada or the United States, I would be really, really surprised if you had 10% with family-run farms. You know, so it's a very, very different structure, and it's put us in a situation of being very precarious. You're at a lot of risk to the central planners, right, and their ability to force you via certain measures to do what they want you to do. And so I want to try as best as I can to extract myself from that leverage that they have over me, because it's not going to matter if you've got millions and millions of dollars in the bank. What does it matter?
Right.
Yeah. $20 million in the bank. If they won't let you in the supermarket, they won't let you in the supermarket.
Or they won't let you out of your house. You're locked in a cage. Out of the house. What good is all the quote unquote money?
Yeah.
What good does it
do? And if they ration food, you might say, oh, I'll pay somebody to go and do my shopping for me, and they can have a vaccine card or whatever it might be. Well, not if they ration. So you can't, you've got to try, and if you can't get yourself into a location that takes away that ability to leverage over its populace, then you've got to try and build it where you are. And so, like I said at the start, maybe that's moving to a location where you have more of that, where you've got a community of people and farms and so on and so forth that are already doing that. And for many people, this is going to be an extraordinarily difficult experience, because they go, oh, I want to live in a city. I like to have cafes and I like to have all of this. we're past that.
If you're someone who values freedom. If you're someone who values freedom. If you don't value freedom, then the world is your oyster. You go wherever you want.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the World Economic Forum and their 2030, you know, blog post or whatever, where you'll own nothing, you'll have no privacy, and you'll be happy. If that all looks good to you, then you're going to love the world we're going into. You got nothing to worry about. Chris, why are you so, why do you think the probability is high that we'll run into food shortages? And how do you invest around that? How are you doing that personally for your hedge fund?
Yeah, so there's two elements to this, right? One, I'll answer the last bit and then we'll go back to why I think there's going to be food shortages. You can profit from these things, right? And that's great. That's what my job has been, right? So for us, it's been fertilizer companies. They have the highest sort of profit margins within that space. They're far less easily coerced. So for example, if you've got a large farming chain, right? As we've seen, if you're non-essential, you're non-essential. And you might think, well, food's never going to be non-essential. Ha! Guess what happened in 2020, right? When they said that only supermarkets can remain open. And in the United States, it's roughly 30 to 35%, I think it is, of food that is consumed is not consumed via supermarkets. It's delis and hotels and restaurants and things of that nature. So you take 30, 40% of your food supply that was deemed non-essential. And you might say, oh, well, it's a bunch of delis and stuff. And maybe 10% of them went away and didn't make it through, whatever. No, it goes deeper than that, because they were purchasing from farmers who did not have contracts with the supermarket chains. Okay. And those guys,
they're
bust. A lot of them are bust. And they were plowing their food back into the ground because they were non-essential. So think about the CapEx spending that they've just done in 2020 and 2021. I'll tell you what it looks like.
Right.
That's what it looks like.
Right.
Because A, they didn't make a profit in 2020. And B, when they look forward, they go, what does the future look like? We don't know. There is so much uncertainty that their ability to go out and spend on increasing acreage or anything like that has been massively curtailed. And so
now it's even more centralized than it was before.
It's even more centralized than it ever was before. 100%. And so, you know, because and it comes back to the inflation deflation debate, which I think is the wrong way to think about it, because what we're seeing across the board is an extraordinary amount of destruction of supply, which then on top of it, we've had extraordinary fiscal and monetary expansion. The combination of all of that is leads you into a stagflationary environment, right? You and I might have made more money this last year than any year before, just say, for example. I don't think we did, but never mind. our lifestyle is still worse. My lifestyle's worse. I know your lifestyle's worse.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that's stagflation, literally. And we're the lucky ones. Right? You've got people who've lost their businesses and lost their jobs and everything else. So anyway, so this is happening on a global scale. So the food shortages are definitely coming. And then the other component behind it, of course, is energy, which just comes into this ESG woke carbon neutral narrative. And so the costs in terms of energy have all been rising. You know, we just think about this. Going into the lockdowns, pre-lockdowns, the price of energy now is far higher than it was pre-lockdown.
Great.
But we just stopped the planet. We stopped as many planes flying around. We stopped cars driving around. So is that not destruction of demand? Yes, it is. So then you go, how is it possible that we have prices going up? Because while you're destroying demand by stopping productivity. And by stopping productivity, you're stopping supply.
even faster.
So we've just been decimating supply. And the inflation that we've had to this point now is nothing like what's coming. There's a catch up coming. So we're going to have inflation and we're going to have shortages in the foodstuffs. And I think what is likely to happen is we're going to have rationing. We're going to have emergency powers enacted because they'll say, oh, we've got a food crisis and it was because of the pandemic. And they'll make some bullshit stories up. But what they'll do is they'll exert more control over the economy and more control over our freedoms. You won't be free to choose meat, right? Because they'll say, we're in a crisis. How dare you eat the most expensive of meats? No, you should just eat cabbage and lettuces and eat your porridge, you serf. And so that's, you know, you want to try and the only way that you get out of that is to have the tools that they're using to dismantle those. And so ultimately, I think that's going to happen by virtue of the fact that humans want to be free and they will be forced to go about solving these problems because they'll go, damn it, I can't get enough food for my family at the supermarket and through these rations and everything else. And they'll get together with their neighbors and you'll form new communities and we will solve the problem. But it's not going to come without a lot of pain. Being a lazy guy like me, I'm like, I'd rather drop myself into an environment where that's already built, right? And because the society structure also then doesn't have to go through so much turmoil, because when you go through these periods of turmoil, you're going to have rising crime. You're going to have murders. You're going to have suicides. Like you have, and I hate to be the guy talking about these things because it's all bloody depressing, but that's just the reality if you look through historical periods. And so while that is taking place, you've got the World Economic Forum pushing all these narratives where they're saying you shouldn't eat meat. You've got to eat bugs. You shouldn't be driving your car. It emits, you know, too much carbon. In fact, you shouldn't be breathing. I'm not sure you should actually be alive. I mean, maybe population control better. You know, what about a one-child policy? I mean, these sorts of things are actually... You've read the World Economic Forum stuff. Yeah. I've read it extensively, that together with the IMF. And if you read through the IMF stuff, that's almost even more frightening. And there are those sorts of things that I've just mentioned get dropped in there. And they get glossed over with, you know, these feel-good terminology like sustainability and
equity.
But when you look through what they're actually capitalism. Saying... It's frightening. So the good news, because we need to end on some good news, is that it's failing. Communism always fails, and this one will fail too. And we can see by the increasing narratives that really don't make sense that they're getting much, much more desperate. I'll give you some examples.
And you think certain countries are pushing back too?
Well, there's the combination of things here. Okay. You think about a little child that's just stolen a cookie out of the cookie jar, right? And you come home and you're like, Johnny, there's a cookie missing. And his crumbs on his mouth. And he's like, it wasn't me. I didn't do it. And you're like, what happened? Ah, the dog ate it. And you're like, no, but I just took the dog for a walk. Oh, it was, and then so the next lie comes. A bird flew in, Dad. A bird got it. And you go, oh, but the windows are shut. And you know, and so the lies get more and more ridiculous. Okay. And you know, in the state of Victoria in Australia, there's a gentleman by the name of Dan Andrews, who's the premier there. Now he's locked down the state pretty much, you know, on and off for about 20 months now. And he came out the other day and he said, you can go outside, you got to wear your masks. And if you're going to drink outside, because people will often lift their masks to have a drink, you're not allowed to lift your mask in anymore to drink. You got to drink through your mask.
Come on.
And so you know, that's this, that's similar to the kid. And then there's another one in Queensland. I think it was a health official or something on television who came out saying, this virus is so deadly. It'll come for you and it's going to come for your family and it can go through windows. He said this on live TV. And I retweeted it the other day, jokingly saying, well, thank God for those face cloths, masks that'll protect you then. You know, and so what you've got is really a child that's just coming out with ever more ridiculous narratives in order to create more and more fear, because what they're doing is not working. They're trying to get their vaccination rates up and up and up because they can't enact their global green pass without sufficient vaccination rates. Mm-hmm. If you've only vaccinated 40, 50% of the population and you can't get the rest on board, and you then turn around and you try and eliminate that 50% from society, you're going to get a hell of a lot of pushback. You're going to have war.
And an economic collapse.
And an economic collapse. And so this is why they have to try and get 70% or 60, 70, 80. They'll sort of keep changing the ballpark. And you might go, why is it 60% in some countries? Why is it 70? Well, the reason is they just need a vast majority so that they can enact these global green passes, because the extra 20% can just be dealt with. They can just be excluded from society. And in fact, they'll use those who've been vaccinated to chastise those who have not been vaccinated and will feel threatened by them. And we're seeing all those sorts of narratives being dribbled out now anyways.
Right.
So the good news is that this is failing, and you can see it's failing because they're getting ever more desperate with ever more ridiculous statements. And the good thing with that is that even people who are for the vaccines or for the lockdowns are looking at it and going, hang on a second, that doesn't really make sense. Yeah. And so when that doubt creeps in, when you start losing trust, you go, well, if they're lying to me about that, what else might they be lying to me about? And so trust is being shattered. Now, when all frauds are predicated on two things, they're predicated on a lie and an ability to enforce the lie. And when your lie is exposed, all you're left with is an ability to enforce it. In other words, authoritarianism. So I think it's a guarantee that over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, we're going to see extraordinary amounts of authoritarianism in certain parts of the world, while at the same time, other parts of the world are going to go, hang on a second, this is too risky. Imagine, if you will, that you and I were running some country. We've got a populace that's really upset because we've locked them down and so on and so forth. And they're increasingly distrustful. Now we either really hammer them with, you know, police, military on the streets, water cannons, everything else, or we step back. And it becomes a binary thing, because if we go down the totalitarian route, we really put ourselves at risk, because we will never exit office safely. Right. You literally become a dictator, and then you've got to solidify your power and keep it forever. Mussolini. And it's not just the populace. Yeah, it's not just the populace that you got to worry about. It's all of those other lunatic psychopaths around you, because they all want your position too, right? You've ancient surrounded Rome. Yourself with
ancient Rome. If you ancient study Rome. Ancient Rome, almost you just go through it, and every single guy that gets in power within most, you know, 90% of them within 10 years, some dude kills him. Or sometimes within 10 months, some dude kills him to take power. It's just over and over and over and over and over and over again, to the point where you're like, why on earth would you want to be in charge there? Yeah. Your life expectancy is like 6 months.
And that's the wonderful thing. So now you're a leader there and you're faced with this reality, and you cross that Rubicon and you know you're just now like a leader in Rome, and your lifespan is right. Or you step back and you do something else. And so over the next few years, we're going to see the whole world, I think, splitting into the step back and do something else and into the ancient Rome. And that's going to give us a much clearer path into understanding what the world's going to look like in sort of 10 years' time. And it's very difficult at this point of time to know exactly what that is likely to look like. Right. We're seeing signs of it already, and I've got my suspicions, and I've been writing about them extensively. But the truth is, we're going to have to really keep our eye on this thing like a hawk and watch it. And you know, it will split. It will not work. We can see it already now. You know, anybody who's been looking at Israel, for example, where they vaccinated the vast majority of their population. I think after the Seychelles, it's the most vaccinated population in the world. They now have the highest COVID case numbers in the world because it's actually causing them to get sick. And now they're saying, well, if you got your double jab and you had your green pass to get into restaurants and everything else, well, it's no longer valid unless you take the third jab. Let's have a guess, George. Do you think the amount of people who took the two jabs, that now we're going into the third jab, do you think the amount of people who take the third jab is going to be more or less?
Less.
Of course it is. And so what you're seeing is a withering of trust.
Right.
And so that just, you know, what then, there's a fourth jab, a fifth jab, and you just got to keep your jabs up to keep your access passes.
And the more this trust is lost, the more authoritarian the government becomes.
Exactly. It's an asymmetric trade. Now, that doesn't mean that Israel doesn't turn into a dystopian hell for the next 50, 100 years. It possibly will. But what I'm saying is that these things don't happen in isolation. Israelis will leave. You'll have mass immigration. And they will go to where they are better treated. So do they go to Turkey, north of them? Do they go to, across the sort of Bosphorus into Eastern Europe? I don't know. We can make probabilities and we can make assumptions and we can see which country is doing what, where, and how. But ultimately, economics also will start driving this, right? So you could be sitting there in Montenegro and say, you know what? We're not going to force a vaccine pass. No, I use Montenegro because they're quite a good example. It's fairly heavily Eastern Orthodox, deep distrust of government and of the vaccines and everything else. Their ability for them, I think, to hit, you know, these percentages that are being required or at least wished for is very, very low. And so now if they start getting an influx of people who are coming literally because they don't have it, there's an incentive scheme there. So you go back to the question I asked you before, where you could be sitting there as that leader saying, okay, do we go all Rome on this? And I know I'm gonna cross that Rubicon, and I might my own life expectancy might be in some sort of jeopardy here, or do I do something else? And so that's what the next 10 years is going to look like, in my humble estimation. So it's going to be a bumpy ride, and certainly I think, you know, our world is macro. And I cannot think, if you were put to a test, if you said, okay, you know, like you're a pro athlete, right? And you're going to design, a course for your, you think about, what's that? You guys have got the Ninja Warrior. What's it? That, have you seen that program? In the US, it's called a Ninja Warrior or something. And basically you've got these elite athletes and they've got to get through this obstacle course. Right. And it's, you know, it's climbing ropes and it's balancing on things. And it's just, you know, it's a very, very difficult course.
Yeah. It's like that Japanese game, that extreme elimination challenge. That was awesome.
Yeah, yeah,
they knock those Japanese guys off the ropes and they just bash their face. They hit them with bowling balls. It's great.
Yep. That's it. And so, like, you know, these are these sort of, you know, it's the, like the Olympics of these, CrossFit type, you know, things. Anyways, when you go into the macro world, if we were to design a similar course where the best of the best are going to try and get through this thing, I think it's what we've got in front of us, to be honest. I bloody hope we can do a good job of it, but I mean, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, man. Well, I know I've kept you long here. Just as a reminder for all the viewers and listeners, Chris is one of my partners, along with Lynn Alden, in Rebel Capitalist Pro. And we talk about these topics and also how to invest for this crazy world that we're going into in this macro version of the most extreme elimination challenge, or American Gladiator, or whatever. That was a good show, I think, too, back in the 90s. But we're going into that. And for those people who aren't prepared, you're going to be a victim. You just are, from the standpoint of freedom and your portfolio, your financial freedom. So I can't encourage you enough to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro at georgegammon.com/pro. And then, Chris, for the viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do or your social media, where can they follow you?
Actually, social media, I'm thinking of giving up entirely, to be honest.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
But so, I mean, I write a blog on capitalistexploits.at or .com will get you there as well. And then I run Glenorchy Capital as well. So that's glenorchycapital.net, which is for high net worth individuals, and we manage money for them. So those are the places you can find me.
Awesome.
But on the point of course, Rebel Capitalist Pro as well, you can find me. And the benefit that you've got with RCP is that you've got someone way, way smarter than me in Lynn Alden. So definitely check it out.
Yeah. All right, man. I appreciate your time. I wish you well. And let's keep thinking this through, and let's be a part of the macro elite that solve this puzzle and get through to the other side. And let's bring everyone, or as many people as we can, along with us.
Amen to that, because we need it.
Hi, guys. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to the next Rebel Capitalist Live event. If you are a fan of the Rebel Capitalist show, I guarantee you will love the live event. The next one is Houston, where you can meet and listen to speakers, all your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist show. People such as Dr. Ron Paul, Chris Cole, Lynn Alden, Luke Grohman, just to name a few. If you want to check out the rest of the speaker list and find out how you can attend, we'll put a link in the description below, or you can just go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. This is an event where you can learn to build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. But it's not just about building wealth. It's about increasing your freedom and networking with like-minded individuals, fellow rebel capitalists. It's an amazing event. I know you'll absolutely love it. Check out rebelcapitalistlive.com, and I will see you in Houston.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com, or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.